Check two, two, check two, checking. Two, three, check two, two. Check two.
Check, check, check.
All right.
All right, we're here with Zach Poff, and we're listening to Pond Station, is it called?
It is Pond Station.
And tell the listeners what Pond Station is. What are we listening to?
Pond Station is a platform for translating some of the phenomenon from a pond that we usually can't hear with our ears, and to make that something that we can experience without having to be under the water. So it's physically a sculpture that's floating on top of the pond right now, out the window, and it has hydrophones that dip down.
If you're listening, it's to your left.
And the hydrophones dip down into the water, and what we're hearing is a lot of the respiration of plants. We're hearing some bugs and I don't know what other stuff is down there, but now that I have...
What's that noise?
That little rhythmic sound? I don't really know. But now I hear it pretty often in the last couple of weeks, so now I can take this to some, you know, people who actually know these things and ask them.
It could be a particular kind of fish or a frog or...
Maybe. I mean, I think most fish communicate more in the ultrasonic range.
More telepathy?
Definitely. it could be frogs. It could be... I have a hunch a lot of it is insects. Insects that are, you know, what is that called? Stridulation, where they rub their legs together, and these little thorny parts of their legs make these crackling noises, like crickets. You can also hear traffic going by.
Yeah, how much of the sound is you think is from above the... explain what microphones or hydrophones or what is picking up the sound first?
Sure. So a hydrophone is an underwater mic. It's in this case it's a piezoelectric transducer, which is the same kind of thing you put on an acoustic guitar. Like a contact mic is another name for it. And so that translates the vibration of objects into sound that you can hear. And in this case, it's got a little air gap inside of it, kind of like a bubble. And then there are these transducers on either side. And as the vibrations in the water are squishing and contracting...
The air inside?
Yeah, basically. It's pushing against the pillow of air, and that provides this sort of spring that gives you the relief that you need to get sound to come out. So essentially, it's only responding to sound under the water, but a lot of the sound from the air vibrates the water also. And we're pretty shallow. It's only maybe 3 feet into the water. A lot of times the most interesting sounds I found are in these habitats that are in between two other kinds of areas. You know, so as you have these like grasses and reeds and stuff that grow up to the edge of the pond, then when you go down in the first couple feet of water, you get a lot of sunlight. So you get all these, like, you know, algae and things are growing in there. And there's a lot of food there. So there's all kinds of activity there. Whereas if you go a little deeper, you get a different kind of activity. And in this case, not as much. There's a lot going on.
He was playing
right now
a song or something there.
Yeah, it's polyrhythms.
Wait, now he's a little bashful.
He knows we're listening. Yeah, that there's a sound recordist, composer, acoustic ecology angle to this, in the sense that these things are available now at the studio here, as well as online. And you can kind of mine these things and use them as triggers to do other things with. I can imagine an installation of some kind where every time one of these loud events happens, it's triggering some physical thing to happen in space.
You're trying to make slaves out of the animals in the pond.
Make them
sound slaves.
They could be our muse. That's how I like to look at it.
An orchestra.
Yeah, or we could be the orchestra and they could be the conductor. That's one way to think of it.
Explain a little how well or not well water, how sound waves move through water.
Yeah, sound moves faster in water and to some extent more efficiently. We wouldn't know that because our ears are so tuned to work in air that the stiffness and the incompressibility of water is a real challenge for our ears. So when we stick our heads under the water, we don't hear what we're hearing now through this feed. But what the hydrophones are able to do is more closely match what we call the impedance, or the sort of natural springiness of the water. They're basically harder than our eardrums. That was a big truck going by. It's interesting, because here in the studio, we got the windows open, and I can hear in real time when a truck goes by.
The truck went by, and then we heard a second later the truck passed. Yeah, the pond is a little further down the road. And
well, are we listening to the web stream?
Yeah, so it's also
so
a little
it's
later.
Delayed. Yeah. Yeah. So we hear it through our mics and through our ears right here live in the studio, and then we also hear a kind of transformed version of it 30 seconds later.
Where's the server? The pond sound is coming from the hydrophone in the pond to... From a transmitter up just on the top of the pond that's sending it back here to the study center, and then it goes to a server. Where is the server?
Right. Well, right now it's using Locus Sonus, which is a user-generated sound map of live mics all over the world. So this particular infrastructure that I've set up here, part of it was to be part of Reveille, which just happened a few days ago. And Reveille was this yearly event that'll hopefully happen again next year, where they track the sounds of the dawn, you know, the dawn chorus from different points on the Earth throughout a whole 24-hour cycle. So as starting in London, moving west, every half hour or so, they're switching to a new live mic that's a little further west, and eventually it came over to us.
About 5:45 a.m. or something?
Yeah. And we transmitted the pond station from there, so that feed was that whole event was partially related to Locus Sonus. So Locus Sonus is a sound art and performance research group in the UK and I think in France, and they have this sound map that's different from a lot of other sound maps because it's not recordings; it's all live mics. So you can tune in at any time of day. It's constantly changing. Some streams go down. Some of them only work during the day. Some of them only work at night. Anyone can contribute to it. You can just throw a mic out your window, attach it to your computer, and stream live. Or in the case of what we're doing, we're using a Raspberry Pi little mini computer, an inexpensive single board computer. And they have provided, the folks who run Reveille have provided an image, like an SD card image, that'll just turn any Raspberry Pi into a streaming box with very little user input. You know, you just set a couple of things to make it work with their account, and you're on the air. It's amazing. So that's what you hear in the background is being pulled from the pond, transmitted over a digital radio link to a box that's 5 feet away from us. Then that is going out over the internet to the Locus Sonus server system there.
Is it in London or where is it?
I don't know. I think it actually might be in France. And then from there, it's coming back here to Studio A, where it's being caught on the laptop and put into the board so that we can hear it while we speak.
And out through the speakers or headphones if you prefer.
So one of the things that's nice about this piece is that it's a constantly changing resource. So during the day, a lot of the sounds you hear are based on things like sunlight, right? Like I was saying before, there's a lot of plant respiration. There's a lot of things that involve food chains that start with the sun. So when it's really cloudy for more than an hour or so, things quiet down a lot and different kind of sounds emerge. And at night, it gets very quiet and almost all of the bubbling sounds that you hear go away. But some of the rhythmic sounds, which are like that, like tuck, 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 some of those things stick around at night.
And you'll hear it with it's solar powered. So is it going to last all night?
It doesn't. The way it's set up right now is it runs during the day. Then when it thinks that night has fallen, then it switches to like a countdown, and it still runs, but it only runs for maybe an hour or an hour and a half, provided that the batteries are still looking good. And then in the morning, it'll notice that the light has come up again, and it'll turn itself back on for that full day. So it does run into the night, but not, there's nothing happening at like midnight.
Is there a way to output the telemetry data to a website so that countdown, well, like we make a Pond Station website on the Wavefarm, some .org somewhere, there can be a page that tells you, you can see that countdown or information about the how sunny it is? Or
yeah, absolutely. That's part of the plan. We'll see how it evolves in the next couple months. I'm sort of doing it in phases to make sure things are working, but it's actually already putting its data up to a server called Device Hub, which is a kind of an Internet of Things server system where if you have any kind of widget that you're making that generates small amounts of data, you can get an account on Device Hub, and it'll make nice little graphs and charts and things for you. So right now that's still in the experimental stages, but the goal is to have that data be out there alongside the sound feed, both for me for troubleshooting in case things break, and also so that you can get a feel for, oh, this kind of sound happens when there's this much sun, and this other kind of sound happens when there's, you know, when there hasn't been sun for 5 hours.
When if you were, like you were suggesting, if you were coordinating a performance, it might be interesting to know that it was very sunny. Your information was going to be very sunny, or your information was going to be very cloudy beforehand.
Absolutely. it'll change your composition entirely.
You might want to, it's maybe the difference between composing a ballad, say, and a roaring march.
Yeah, well, right now they're kind of roaring.
And you said you were going to try to figure out what the different noises are. I mean, how can you tell what the different noises are?
Well, right now, because I am not trained very well in this stuff, I can't. But my plan is to get some representative sample recordings.
Now, like Cornell University has right. That bird.
I know it well.
All those bird sounds. So is there a repository for underwater sounds?
No, especially for freshwater underwater sounds. I mean,
there's a lot of more ocean
exactly.
Hydrophones. All over the world, there's these ocean hydrophones that are mostly military uses, or?
Well, from what I understand, they're leftovers from...
World War II?
No, from the Cold War, from SOSIS. I forget what that acronym stands for, but it was to listen for submarines. So they built this...
Also underwater atomic testing.
Yeah, like seismic blasts from underwater tests, yeah. But what they were really trying to do is find the engine noises of different kinds of submarines. So there was a whole catalog of engine noises from different Soviet subs, and the NATO countries had listening stations all over the place. At first, there were people physically sitting there with headphones on, or were looking at chart recorders that would show sound levels over time, and when they would see some kind of anomaly on the recorder, then they would back up the tape and listen to it.
There's all these recordings online you can find of underwater sounds that are unexplained, and there's theories about, oh, maybe an iceberg fell and made this giant noise that the entire ocean, Pacific Ocean, heard. That's how far the waves travel, that there can be sounds underwater that cover the entire Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, yeah. Well, part of it, one of the reasons that submarine listening system works so well is there's temperature gradients in the ocean that act a lot like the... in the radio world, they act a lot like the difference between the crust of the Earth and the ionosphere, where, you know, if you look at like AM even, or definitely shortwave broadcasting, they aim their antennas up at the ionosphere to bounce across the horizon so that you can get, obviously, across the curvature of the Earth. And underwater, there's a thing called the SOFAR channel, which is another acronym. And that is this temperature... layering, where sound tends to get caught and echo and bounce. So instead of dissipating in all directions, it's funneled into a narrower band, and so it travels even farther. So whales are aware of that. And when whales want to communicate over great distances, they'll dive to certain depths where they know that the temperature gradient, or, you know, they don't know, but they have noticed.
They may, yes.
Yeah, it depends on Depends on your.
Whales are fabulous transmitting machines. There's the, what is the narwhal that has the.
Oh, right, the narwhal.
That thinks that, I mean, that has a big unicorn kind of horn that scientists figured out was an antenna, basically, right?
Yeah, it's somehow used for sonar or magnifying sounds.
And then there's the, you know the story about the loneliest whale in the world? I think they're actually making a feature movie about this whale. There's a whale that, one whale in the Pacific Ocean communicates at 52 megahertz, and all the other whales communicate somewhere between 10 and 20, I think, megahertz.
Kilohertz.
Kilohertz, excuse yeah. me, yes. So this one single whale
really?
Can't communicate with any other whale in the ocean. It's speaking, and I guess scientists assume listening at that frequency. Maybe it's only speaking at that frequency. Maybe it's only... but I think it was like somebody ridiculous, like Keanu Reeves or somebody has commissioned it for a movie or something.
But they're fantastic.
About the loneliest whale in the world. So I'm wondering, I guess, with it, are we going to find that there's the loneliest animal in the pond?
It's certainly possible. Or, you know, one of the explanations for those unexplained hydrophone sounds in the deep ocean is the horrible monster from H.P. Lovecraft stories, Cthulhu, who is this, like, eater of souls. And apparently that's like a leading explanation among wonderful people with fantastical imaginations, that this bizarre farting noise that someone heard, you know, 5 years ago in the ocean is actually the emergence from after a great long slumber of the evil, dark god Cthulhu. So watch out.
Coming is that in the Pacific
coming
or the
to
Atlantic?
A pond near you. That's a good question. Which way should we run?
Is there any sound that's really surprised you? That was a good one there.
Yeah, honestly, I was in this pond 2 years ago making recordings with a less sensitive system.
Although the same hydrophones, right?
Yeah, same hydrophones, but different preamp electronics. And I found that I was getting a lot more of the bubbling and a lot less of the rhythmic, clearly animal sounds.
And the bubbling is, you were saying before, there's a lot of plant respiration. Their plants aren't actually shouting. They're just releasing
Just oxygen bubbles. Yeah, and which you can see. I mean, if you look at the surface of a pond when the sun's shining on it, you see little bubbles of air popping up all over the place. It looks almost like, you know, fish, you know, like popping up to the surface. But they're actually just little bubbles of air that are coming from the photosynthetic reaction of all these plants underneath the water.
They're not little cartoon text bubbles?
They may be. They may be.
Someone can get a translator for that.
Get this hydrophone out of my face. Yeah, so, I mean, this thing is designed to withstand a lot of different weather conditions, and I think it should last a long time, and I'm really looking forward to hearing how things change season to season.
Are you going to leave it in the pond for the winter?
It's a good question. I don't know. The battery inside doesn't want to be charged if it's frozen, but the charger electronics know when it's freezing and will refuse to charge it, so it's not going to blow up.
Does it heat itself? Is it hot at all?
It doesn't generate enough heat to kind of warm itself over the winter. That would be a cool trick. Which reminds me, one of the things that kind of inspired me to go down this road is actually the excitement about space probes, which have an almost similar angle to them, in the sense that you kind of just let the thing out. It does what it does. You hope it does what you want, but it's going to respond to the world around it in different ways. And I was actually kind of inspired by the Rosetta space probe that just went out and deposited a lander onto a comet for the first time in history. And me and my four-year-old daughter were reading about Rosetta and looking at pictures and thinking about it. And I was thinking, you know, there's so much that's unexplored in our normal, average daily lives. And I love using things like contact mics and light listeners that convert vibrations of light into vibrations of sound. Just walking around in an urban environment, you know, and you recognize how much, you know, the bus is vibrating the window of the shop next door and things like that. Things that we tend to either not be able to sense because we just don't have that kind of hardware in our bodies.
Or I think we probably block out a lot of it because it's too much input for us to take in.
Exactly. And we always have something better to do. So I kind of like this pursuit. You know, it's a very simple thing that's just doing one thing. You know, it's just trying to pull the veil back a little bit on what's happening. Because at some moments, it really just seems like this flat, placid, you know, on a windless day, you just see a bunch of water. And it's hard to imagine what could be going on under the surface. And one of the things that I really hope happens with this is that even though it's about being remote, it's about being away from the pond, being able to provide an opportunity to sense things at a distance, it's also something you can listen to while you're standing right next to the pond.
There's actually Wi-Fi on the property, and if you have a personal device in your hand, you can listen to 3 feet under the water from 3 feet above the water.
Exactly. And that's something that I've actually found really kind of exciting just while I've been testing this thing, is that it's not simply this kind of panoptical approach where you're trying to surveil some other place. It actually functions kind of nicely as a kind of enhancement, a way of guiding your attention when you're just really in the place. You know, you're enjoying the pond the way you would enjoy any wonderful body of water on a sunny day. But now there's another thing you can use to help understand some of the connections that are happening under the water.
I've already thought about hosting a some sort of fishing demonstration or performance with the microphones, and I don't.
That would be great. Fishing with Tom.
Are there other? I guess was people swimming? Have people have swam in that pond before? Although
yeah.
I guess they kind of get leeches on them sometimes.
Yeah, that's a pretty swampy pond. The Brave.
I haven't seen. There's a usually they see poisonous. They're not poisonous, but they're water snakes. They're aggressive.
Yeah.
I haven't seen any this year.
No.
I haven't seen them yet.
There is a beaver, though.
Well, you just saw that one day.
Yeah, there was a beaver who was very interested in the pond, but for a very limited amount of time.
He made a lot of noise above the water, too.
Absolutely. And it actually, it's funny. It's funny you mention it, because that actually changed the way that I approached building the physical part of this piece. Because going into it, I kind of had my heart set on building a frame or some kind of skeleton that sits above the water, and then using materials from the property to make this thing kind of blend in so that it looked almost like a little, you know, beavery igloo thing made out of old reeds and, you know, mud. And the electronics would still be in a sealed box inside of it, but it would look more like something that could kind of harmonize with the colors and the structures that you see around you. As soon as I saw that beaver gnawing away tons of brush on the side of the pond, I said, that is not what I'm going to do. I'm going to make this thing out of aluminum, and it's going to not be something that a beaver would be interested in at all.
Yeah, we didn't really can you describe what it looks like to people?
Sure. It's a triangular floating device. I very, very loosely based it on the Apollo lunar lander, which is also based on like a three-legged kind of squat tripod shape with
It has a low center of gravity.
Yeah, but it is lifted off the ground a little bit. And so the same thing's happening here. It's made of aluminum angle and aluminum bar stock, and it has solar panels on two of the three sides of the triangle, and then the third side of the triangle has the electronics box, which is like a sealed waterproof container with the preamplifiers and the transmitter electronics and all kinds of power monitoring gear so that it can stay up and running. So there's a microprocessor in there, an Arduino microcontroller, and that is communicating back here and sending all this, what we've been calling telemetry data, which is like the how much sunlight is striking it, what's the battery level, does it think that the batteries are in good shape or in bad shape, is it going to do anything about that soon, is it going to shut off anytime soon, all that kind of information. It's trying to share that with the studio here so that we don't have to run back and forth to the pond all the time just to see why the thing stopped or something like that.
And it's kind of, it has to be pointed in a certain direction, so the antenna is pointed right at the study center where the receiver is, right? From the transmitter to the receiver, so, and it has to be, it's a directional antenna, or two directional antennas, the telemetry data information and the audio.
Yeah, it's a, in designing this was a great lesson in trusting basic antenna physics. The audio transmitter and receiver pair are a very low-powered... The whole project is running on less than 5 volts. There's a basically a single lithium-ion battery inside of it that's running.
What's that the equivalent for someone, like a toaster or a...
Way less. Like a couple of cell phones. The battery inside of it is about the size of the battery in your cell phone. And it's able to run for hours and hours with no sun at all if it needs to. And the solar array that's running it is kind of overbuilt so that even if there's a week of cloudy days, it might not be able to run very long at night, but at least during its normal cycle during the day, it will be on and it will be running and it won't be getting itself in trouble.
And really, mostly, the only time there's a solid week of gray skies is in the winter.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, I haven't thought ahead enough to see what to do about it in the winter. I know the hydrophones themselves have overwintered here for 2 years, unplugged. They were just hanging out, and they are in perfect shape. So if I'll do some thinking, if I think the electronics can handle the winter, then it would be great.
Well, I'm also wondering about the frame, if the frame will be crushed sort of by the ice, or as it expands and contracts.
It'll probably be all right. I'm more concerned with whether snowpack will cover the whole box, and the box is waterproof-ish. You know, it's a sealed O-ring sealed enclosure, but if there's 2 feet of snow on top of it,
to me, I'm not positive, but I don't think the pond gets the snowpack that like the rest of the ground. Maybe it's true, maybe not. I don't remember because I don't. If it snows 2 feet deep, then I'm not out walking by the pond as much.
I'm sure. But one thing that I would love to get, if it happens, is the beautiful sound of the ice as it thaws in the spring. Because, man, I've heard some wonderful recordings of hydrophones in lakes. And when that ice starts to crack, it makes these wonderful, almost... sci-fi laser gun noises as it just kind of goes like mixed with all these high frequency crinkles and crackles.
Yeah, the sounds of the glaciers melting are probably some of the most dramatic in so many different ways recordings.
True. Yeah. I think I'm trying to think of whose recordings I've heard most recently. I think it was Jana Vinderen, who does a lot of recordings of in the North Sea, a bunch of recordings of fish. And ultrasound. She had a piece in the MoMA Sound Art Show last year that was all material that began as things that humans can't sense. You know, it was a lot of ultrasound and stuff like that that had been slowed down and turned into a multi-channel surround composition. And I think, if memory serves, I think I've heard recordings from her of like pack ice as it split up and moved around, and it was just gorgeous. So if something like that happens here, that would be... that'll be worth a quiet winter.
And so as of now, we'll put the URL out and people will be able to tune in basically from sunrise to sometime after sunset.
Exactly. Yeah. And over time I'll tune it. I set it pretty conservatively right now because I didn't know exactly how well it's going to charge and all that. But after looking at the telemetry data over a couple weeks, I can reset some of those variables so that it runs even longer at night.
And is that stuff you can do some by remote control? You can.
Unfortunately, that particular kind of tweak I have to do in the pond.
But there are some things that you can actually change from afar with this.
Yeah, it's. I tried to balance between making it easy to play with and modify and making it super reliable. And so one of the goals of it is that if all the telemetry fails, the audio should keep going. So if the receiver here in Studio A, the telemetry receiver, which is how we're communicating back and forth to the machine, if that somehow disappears, it should not affect the action of the machine. So that kind of puts limits on how much remote controlling you can do, because if it's depending on a remote control somewhere, and that remote control disappears, then it doesn't know what to do when night falls, you know. So it makes all of its decisions autonomously, but some of the parameters we can update over the air, and some we can't.
All right, is there anything else that we should mention that we forgot to talk about?
I don't think so. I think the only thing I would end with is just that a big thanks to Wavefarm for giving me the opportunity to come and do this project. It was more involved than anticipated, and I've gotten a lot of support from you guys in making it happen, and I'm really happy you wanted to have it in the pond to begin with. Whoa. That was
sounds like a splash.
Yeah, that was definitely a splash. I'm looking forward to the evening times when the fish start jumping, because you'll definitely hear splashes then.
And what about the bugs flying above? Will that...
In this iteration, no. It's a modular system, so I'm starting with just getting the hydrophones running. But I've also tested a couple other things to add to it, like conversion of light to sound. One of the things I was working on the last 2 weeks, which didn't make the cut in the end, is a laser microphone. So it at night, when things are not really happening too much under the water, I'm thinking of things to add to the mix to keep some activity running around the clock. And one of those things is there are tons of bug larvae and things, like mosquito larvae, who are attracted to light. And if you shine a light into the water at night, you can see all these things swarming around your light, and the fish will come too to some extent. So by shining a laser in there and bouncing it back into a couple of photocells, you can actually sonify the movements of all these little insect bodies under the water. And it sort of sounds like this hissy kind of tumultuous... I mean, it's funny, it sounds a whole lot like what it looks like, which makes sense because it's the vibrations of light off of their bodies that are being turned into sound that you hear. But that'll be an option we can tie in later once we get this thing running the way
it should. Well, now you can hear a little bit probably. The bugs will affect the sound, and the fish will come up to feed, and they will land on the water, and there'll be activity around the bugs.
Yeah, and different bugs who are making noises right now in the water will change over. You know, as the day progresses, you'll get different waves of insects who are active at different times of day, who like water at a certain temperature. You know, depending on what they're eating and what's eating them, you'll probably hear waves of different, you know, different occupants coming and going. Maybe we'll get a turtle.
That's the slow sounds. Is that a frog or someone squeaking a door?
There's an entire Foley studio under the water that we never knew about.
If we start hearing old radio theater.
Yeah. Well, here's some corny detectives and thunder sheets. That would be great. That's what happens when the hydrophones turn off at night. They switch to radio theater mode. Oh my God, there it is. Well, glad we had this moment, Tom.
All right, Zach Poff with Pond Station, now on the air under the water at the Wave Farm in the pond, and available during daylight hours, Eastern daylight hours, I guess. All right, thanks for all this.
Lovely.